Well, my 10 years being pastor here, I've never given a sermon on child rearing. So I thought today might be an appropriate time to start. I was hoping for, 20 to 50 little babies to bless, but those days are kind of past us. But there are many, many children in the church, and we're getting more. I was really encouraged at the feast to see so many. Salem has quite a number. Of course, many of our families have moved away, but we were able to see Stu and Tammy and a couple others who were, you might say, refugees from Portland, as I call them. I see them around the country, and they're doing well, but I want to begin today over in Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16 is one of the places where God says very plainly that children belong to him. When we have children, the first one especially you think is going to break, and you're just so worried about them. After you have the third or fourth, we need to sort of throw them in the corner and say, well, they'll be fine. A little exaggeration, but let's just say you're not quite as concerned about them. But the important thing that we must understand, especially as we live in a society that has been deceived into thinking that what they call abortion or the murder of innocent babies is somehow okay, spacing all of the false labels that are put on evil things, it's not choice. Actually, it is. In fact, someone asked me one time years ago, are you pro-choice? I said, yeah, I'm 100% pro-choice. They said, what, you're a minister? I said, but this condition, the choice is made when the clothes are on. After the baby's coming, then there's no such thing as a choice to murder the baby. So you can say you're pro-choice, but the choice is made before any new life is created. They call it things like women's health. It's not. They call it things like women's rights. There's no right. The first right in the Declaration of Independence is the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So the right to life is first. But that's a political issue that has moral underpinnings that we're not going to solve until Jesus Christ returns. Ezekiel 16 and verse 20. I'm sorry, did... No, wait a minute. That can't be the right... Where did they get that at? I'm sorry. So the wrong page there. I lost my really, really nice pair of glasses on one of the ferries over in Greece. So this is my backup pair, and I went to Costco and ordered a new pair, but it's not in yet. But at least these lenses are good. Okay, Ezekiel 18 and verse 20. Moreover, 16 and verse 20, you took your sons and daughters whom you bore to me. So when we have children, we bore them to God. They're not ours forever. They're ours to take care of. They're ours to teach. They are ours to make sure they grow to adulthood with an understanding of God. But God says we bore them to him. They are not always under our authority. They are always under God's authority. And so when God claims those children are his, he has a right to. And of course, we live in a time where they are being thrown to the wind, where life has been reduced as far as the value goes. Let me continue on here in verse 21. The last part of the verse here. You sacrifice them to be devoured, where your acts of harlotry is small matter. You have slain my children and offered them up to be causing them to be passed through the fire. Now, passing through the fire meant to devour them, to kill them, because the fire was a statue to Molech. There were a couple others, but different names. But Molech, the god of the Philistines and also up to the north, was a god who, whether he was made out of brass or out of stone, had two outstretched arms. And there are those statues even today that they find in archaeology. And they would start a fire under the statue, and they would lay babies on there and have them burned alive as some sort of offering to Molech. Today we do it differently, either through a medical procedure or after the children are born, we simply neglect them and don't raise them and train them as God requires. Both are very equal, or certainly not equal, but close to it, in evil in God's eyes. And next, in Leviticus 18:21, God said, "You shall not let any of your seed pass through the fire, neither shall you profane the name of your God." It is a profane thing to sacrifice a being made in God's image. God simply says it is profane to do that. Molech, the god that children were sacrificed to, is a demon god that some say is basically another name for Nimrod. But after the flood, when Nimrod began to organize organizations or tyrannical governments, that the god Molech was simply a reminder of Nimrod, who wanted to be worshipped even after he was dead. So the act of making one's children pass through the fire was simple and horrific. It was simply murder. And of course, we are to be, it was a sign that the idol was more important than the true God. And of course, that's pure idolatry. So in preparing for this, I decided I would go back through some of my old notes. I used to have files and files and files. Most of them I've scanned and put on a computer. And it was a very joyous day about 9 years ago when I took an entire wooden file cabinet, four great big drawers, out to my burn pile and burned it, complete with all the files. Because I scanned the ones I wanted, the rest were just old. I didn't need any more. So things are not quite what they were. So now when I go back to get old articles from the past, I have to go to the Herbert W. Armstrong Searchable Library, or is it the HWA Library, which isn't quite as searchable. But on the Herbert W. Armstrong Searchable Library, I put in children, and there were 50 articles just with the name children and another 100 or so about childbearing. Now, by comparison, this is not the best experience I've ever had. I went to United Church of God website and did the same thing. It's woefully deficient. It is. There are a few articles here and there. There are a few sermons from many, many years ago. So I'll take responsibility for that as much as anybody else, because I'm on the writing staff. I edit everything that the church prints, and I can write any article I want to write. And so I think that's something I need to do after I transition. Of course, the word transition means a lot different in today's parlance, especially in Portland, than what it means. I'm going to transition to do more writing after they find a replacement for me, but that's in the future. Mr. Shaby and I have talked a number of times. He has a long list of writing projects that he feels need to be done. So and I think because of the article I write each week, he feels I'm a pretty good person to do it after I no longer have to spend as much time pastoring. At any rate, there are a few good articles and a few things on the United Church of God's website, but the Herbert Armstrong Searchable Library is a vast library of childbearing principles, truths. I read through a number of them. I only brought about half of the ones that I brought, but I was just amazed at how many articles and how many things the church printed during those years that were how to tithe, how to get in better shape, how to have a healthy diet, how to seek God. I mean, there's so many how to, this is how you do it articles. And I think maybe we need to get a little more focused on that in our own publications. We're okay with principles, we're teaching spiritual truths, but as far as practical, this is how you do it. We just simply haven't gotten to the level of excellence that was reached by the church back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So I decided to divide this sermon into three categories: love, teach, and discipline. Now, obviously, you can give a sermon on all three of those, so this is not a three-sermon series. It's a one-sermon survey. So the first thing is, let's turn over to Genesis chapter 19. A requirement to be in the family of Abraham, which we are, we're in the family of Abraham. Abraham's the heirs, we're heirs according to his promise. We are heirs of his family promise that God gave him. Genesis chapter 18 and verse 19. God says of Abraham, "I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham all the things that he's spoken about him." So one of the first qualifications here as far as Abraham's character goes that we have is that he will command his household after him, and they would keep the way of righteousness and justice. You know, what a tremendous responsibility parents have. But in this case, it doesn't say Abraham and Sarah. It says Abraham. He was the spiritual head of his house, that he may command his children, and so that God may then bring the blessings on him that he had commanded. Now, Abraham, as you know, had a number of children after Isaac. Abraham and Keturah had 12, so there was certainly many more after that. And, of course, he had Ishmael before that. But he was commanded to make sure his children grew up in, were trained in, and understood the righteous way of living that God had for him. And of course, Genesis 26:5 says he kept God's commandments and statutes and also his charge and the things that he commanded him to do. I want to go over now to Isaiah chapter 54. Isaiah chapter 54 and verse 13. Let me see here. There we go. It says, all your children shall be taught by the Lord, and great shall be the peace of your children. If you are taught the way of God, the result is peace. That's what the Bible says. So many are today not peaceful. Anxiety is the fastest growing condition of our youth. If you haven't heard Robert F. Kennedy's assessment on the sickness of our society, especially of our children, which he's given talks on several times, I suggest you find it. I think the best assessment was, I think the one he gave in New Hampshire about 5 months ago. But he mentions, by the way, Robert F. Kennedy and I are about 2 months apart in age, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Now, I used to joke, it was the truth, but it was a joke, that Oprah Winfrey Walter Payton, I think, and Steve Largent and I were all born the same week. And 3 out of 4 of us are world famous. That's true. Never guess which one's not world famous. But at any rate, we have here a very important principle in Isaiah 53, verse 54 and verse 14. That says, all your children shall be taught by the Lord, great peace, or great shall be the peace of your children. But of children who were children when I was a child, and I can quote RFK Jr. on this because we are the same age, the autism rate was 1 in 10,000. Today it's 1 in 34 for girls, 1 in 22 for boys. How in the world did that happen? And so many other things, just the fact of just general health, general diseases. 1 in 5 American youth have chronic diseases of some kind. We never had that. When I was a child, everybody died of a heart attack or a stroke when they were like 80. We hardly heard of anybody who was sick. So it's their national, and it's infected the church. We are a part of it. Unfortunately, we're supposed to be better, but even an ice that floats on top of the glass of water, if the entire level of water goes down, the ice goes down too. When I was first camp director, well, that would go back a lot of years, but in 2011, we have a nurse's office. All medications have to go to the nurse's office, and then the students come in, the campers come in the evening, normally before or after dinner, and they're able to have the medication. We cannot allow medications in a dorm. So the first year, I think we had 5, maybe 3 student campers who had some sort of medication. My last year as camp director, 2 years ago, there were, I think Christine told me, 38 campers that had medications every night, and almost all of them were anti-anxiety medications. Man, what is going on? God's children shouldn't be anxious about anything. I mean, what are they worried about? Have to wait a month to get a new cell phone? Have to do their homework? We all had to do homework. We also had to do chores. We also had to do all sorts of things to make sure we had enough money to buy something because our parents wouldn't give us any money. They didn't have any to give. So what's wrong that we have so many campers, so many people in our church, in God's church, going through anxiety? I mean, the world's certainly causing anxiety. Look what's going on in our nation with regard to the elections. But we just got done with the Feast of Tabernacles, which was full of hope about a new time coming, a new world coming. So teaching our children God's way of life should result in peace and them having peace in their life, not in anxiety. I want to go over to Proverbs now, Proverbs chapter 29. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 15. Sometimes when I read this, I almost cry because it's sort of the story of my first granddaughter. Proverbs 29 and verse 15 says, the rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. And there are children who are simply left to themselves. So as most of you know, I have 11 natural-born grandchildren. But at one time, I kind of had a My first granddaughter, I called her. She was not really my granddaughter, except that we were very good friends, and I joked that she was my granddaughter. We lived in Gig Harbor, and we were up there about about 2 years when I was sitting. Actually, I'd come home with a load of firewood. I'd gone out to Charlie Green's and gotten a load of firewood, and I was going to stack it. I went inside, and I heard this knock on the door. And we lived at the end of a row where there were four houses. We were the third house. And I opened the door, and there's this little girl, about 5 years old, strawberry red hair, just really, you know, cute as could be, kind of like Abby Volk's hair, same color. And she says, "Hi." I said, "Well, hello, who are you?" She said, "Well, I'm Morgan." She says, I said, "Oh, really?" She says, "I like to work." She says, "Do you have any work?" I said, "Well, now this is music to my ears." So I said, "Well, I'm unloading firewood. Would you like to?" "Yes, I would." So she comes out, and she gets up in the truck, and she hands me all this firewood. And then I said, "Are you hungry?" She said, "Yeah." So she came in the house, and my wife came out of the office. She said, "Who is out here with you?" I said, "This little girl just showed up, and she's got this red, you know, red hair, and she's just the cutest little thing." And she says, "Well, if nobody, we don't find out where she lives or, you know, where she's from, we got to call the police at some point here." I said, "Well, we'll wait." So 5 hours after she showed up, had dinner with us, knock on the door. "Is there a little girl over here?" It was her mother from next door, who we'd seen, but we never had met her because we hadn't been there that long. We said, "Yeah, she's been here." She says, "Oh, yeah, her name's Morgan." She said, "Come on, Morgan, let's go home." And so over the next, I would say, 6 months, actually it was over a year, but especially all through the summer, almost every day they'd be knocking on the door, and open the door, and Morgan would say, "Rex, what work do we have today?" So she helped me pick berries in the garden. She helped pick pit cherries. I bought a little cherry pitter a little girl could use always. She didn't pit them very much, so when we started doing cherries later in the year, we found a lot of pits. But she sort of became my little first granddaughter. I taught her how to drive the lawn tractor, and she just had so much fun. One time she went in our bathroom, got a pair of scissors, and cut off half her hair. And we went in the bathroom and thought, "What in the world is this?" So we had to explain to her mom. Although her mom rarely came and got her. Morgan just came and went. Sad story is, Morgan's mother was a marijuana addict. And she didn't want her daughter. So no one gave that little girl any attention. Her mom screamed a lot. We could hear her mother screaming profanity all through the neighborhood quite often. And when she was screaming at Morgan, I wanted to go over there and change. Because Morgan and I were pretty good buddies. And at any rate, so I had a little boat, a little old fiberglass boat, and I got to know Morgan's grandfather. He came over once or twice to get her, and he was a really nice old fellow. He was the mother's father, and I said, "Hey, do you mind if would you and I take Morgan fishing? I asked her, and she's never caught a fish." He said, "I think we can arrange that." So a few days later, he came over, and we loaded up the boat, went out to Bay Lake, a little lake there in a peninsula about 5 miles from where we lived. And you had to fish it in the spring before the weeds got it through. So we put some, you know, eggs and some worms overboard, and it wasn't very long for him. Morgan caught her first fish, and she stood there and reeled it in. Of course, she was flopping all over the boat. She finally got it in, and she started jumping up and down because she was so excited. And she jumped up onto the gunwale and was going to leap out into the water just because she was jumping up. And I reached out and grabbed her before she got into the water. But anyway, she was a lot of fun, and sad thing is that we didn't see her for a while, and her mother would, the worst experience we had was when her dad, because her parents weren't married, of course, they were divorced, when he brought her home one time early, and her mother screamed and yelled and called all kinds of profanity because she didn't want that girl home early, and Patty stood there and cried and said, "How could anyone be that cruel to such a nice little girl?" And I said, "Can we adopt her?" I haven't talked to her grandpa. I said, "Look, I would love to raise that little girl. I've raised two girls, and they turned out pretty good. So I'll be glad to raise this little girl and teach her." And he said, "No, her mom's not going to do that." Her mom had another baby, a little boy. So at one point, we didn't see Morgan for a long time, and I saw her out in her yard, actually out in the driveway, about a year later. And I yelled at her and said, "Hey, Morgan, what's going on?" And she walked over kind of spaced out. And I said, what's going on? You want to come over?" So she came to the house, and she says, "I have to have my pills." She says, "I have to go back home and get my pills. Mom says I don't behave. I have to have my pills." And so they had her on Ritalin, and it ruined my first granddaughter. It was like there was nothing left between her ears. She just stood there and stared. Didn't want to work anymore. Didn't want to play. Didn't want to drive the tractor. Didn't want to run the yard. just sat and did nothing because mom was a marijuana addict. If anybody tells you marijuana is harmless, you tell them come talk to me. It killed my sister and it ruined my first granddaughter. And I'm not a big fan of pot. So anyway, a child left to himself comes to nothing. And it's sad. I don't know whatever happened. They moved away and we just never have seen them again. I did see her grandfather at a store and ask him what happened. They just said, well, they're living over in some other part of the Puget Sound. But there are many, many children who are neglected today. And my little Morgan was just one of millions, unfortunately. They grew up in families where God is not known. We had to tell Morgan to stop. We're going to say a prayer now before dinner because she had dinner with us quite often. And she didn't know what to do. She had never heard of God, never heard of praying, never heard of anything. And here she's 5, 6 years old. So we had to tell her, well, you know, God who created the heavens and the earth, we thank him for our food each day. So that may have been the only education that she ever had as far as, you know, God is concerned. But we cannot have children and neglect them. And just as sure as you find out you're going to be having a baby, you have signed a contract with God to spend a lot of time teaching that child as it grows up. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 4, a verse I'm sure you're very familiar with. There are so many wonderful blessings that come from spending time with your children, teaching them, doing things with them, and children that have a lot of parent time are well adjusted, especially if they're learning skills, if they're learning how to even do simple things like mow the lawn, rake the leaves. You know, we raised 3 children. The oldest two went through a pretty traumatic time in the late 90s. But a few people have asked, you know, how did you raise 3 very, very highly accomplished children? I said, well, first place, we didn't have any television. In our growing up years, we were in Alaska from 1990 to 95, and the only thing up there was RatNet. No one knows what RatNet is unless they live. That's Rural Alaska Television Network. And there are repeaters on these hilltops around the major cities and villages, but there were only 2, maybe, I think by the time we left, there were 3 channels. But there were 5 or 6 networks and PBS, whatever. And so it was like a roulette. You didn't know if you're going to have Monday Night Football or not. It might be Oprah. I mean, it might be something. So it was so frustrating. You couldn't watch anything you wanted to, not that we wanted to watch much anyway, but we just basically didn't have a TV for the 5 years. And so we went cross-country skiing, even in the winter when it was dark. We played games. We made sure that the kids were very, very active. And there were a lot of children in the church at that time. We had a lot of them over, camped on the beach, did various things. But the important thing is we didn't have the bad influence of the mind-numbing experience of watching video or screen. You know, they call this latest generation the screen generation because they're always in, you know, screen. And it's just as bad in Europe as it is here. But at any rate, let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 9. Take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen. We have to be very, very diligent that we don't forget the experience God has brought us through, the truth we have learned, lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life and teach them to your children and your grandchildren. You know, there's a great blessing in having grandchildren. Of course, you can enjoy them, and when they do things you don't like, you just kind of turn and look the other way, or perhaps you can talk to them and teach them. No, when we were at the feast this year, we had Josiah and then his little brother, Bronson, who's 3. Josiah's just 6 and a half, and of course, the littlest one, Annalise, turned 2 on the last day of the feast. But children sometimes inherit things from their parents, like personality, drive, energy. And when you have 2 adrenaline junkies get married, you have to really be careful when they start having children. So we first met with Angela and Rick Beam, who we'd known well in college, when Bridget and Jonathan were engaged but not yet married. So Patty says to Angela, she says, you know, Bridget's always been an athlete. She won 11 letters in high school, was rated 20th in the nation in the 200-meter dash, got her a 4-year scholarship through college. She said, I just got this picture I want to show you. She's hanging off this cliff in Thailand, which is 2,000 feet in the air and nothing below her except air and the ocean, which is way, way down there. And she's got this selfie because she's on this rope. And Angel says, oh, I'll show you a picture of my son, Jonathan. He's on a motorcycle, a dirt bike, 50 feet in the air, upside down, because he rode did all these, you know, motorcycle riding. He's also wearing this kind of a transformer outfit, like he's encased in plastic. But at any rate, my daughter said she wouldn't marry him unless he quit doing that, because the chance for, let's just say, brainstem separation is very high. But you get two adults who are, you know, that active, that athletic. You can only imagine what kind of children they raise. The children have a lot of potential, but also a lot of energy. So we'll go over to Ephesians 5. When little Josiah was doing what six-year-olds do, especially ones that are very, very active, I went and sat down with him one morning during the feast, and I said, let's have a little Bible study. And he said, okay, that sounds good. And I wanted to show him a scripture, which is essentially the only scripture in the Bible, the only place where God really says a command to children. And, of course, that command to children, I think you all know what it is very much. But let me make sure I get the right place here, kind of getting ahead of myself. But we need to make sure we are teaching our children, and grandchildren sometimes have a teachable moment. We don't have the same as the parents do, obviously, but we do have a teachable moment with them. And that is something that we must be very, very careful of and make sure we don't let those things pass. Let me see. Let's go on down. Chapter 6 and verse 1. So I read this to Josiah. It says, children, obey your parents. It's the only command in the Bible to children. It's a good one to read to your children. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you. And so you can explain to your grandchildren, as I did to Josiah, that, you know, his life will be a good one if he learns to obey his parents and listen to them and do what they say. All children have a challenge with that. You know, child rearing is, it tests your patience, tests your love, but certainly it's very, very rewarding. Well, let's go back to Deuteronomy 4 now, just so that we have, don't forget that. Verse 10 says, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, or Sinai, when the Lord said to me, gather the people to me, and I will hear them, hear their words, that they may learn to fear me all the days they live upon the earth, that they may teach their children. Excuse me. At the very beginning of Mount Sinai, God intended them to teach their children and have them assemble them there. So we are to be, I think, very, very cognizant of the fact that teaching is the first responsibility we have as parents. If we spend time teaching them, we'll spend less time disciplining them. I've told parents for many, many years that you're going to spend time with your kids, lots of time, whether it's teaching them and enjoying doing enjoyable things with them now, or fighting with them, disciplining them, going down to whatever it might be, the jail, or having other issues with school. You're going to spend time with your kids either in a positive, uplifting way or in a negative way. So the choice is yours. For many, many years, too many people neglected, and still do, the just enjoyable, fun things doing with their children, and the memories that they make, and the bond that is given there, and the fact that the kids then really understand that mom and dad care about them and want to do things with them. My wife likes to joke, or she used to joke, that we were one of the first people that we know of that had a child labor law. And the child labor law was, if there's labor to be done, all childs will engage in it. So all children were going to work, no matter what it was. And growing up on the farm, that's the way she was raised, that everybody had to join in with the work. So whether it was working in the garden, cleaning the house, if there was work to be done, then our children were participating in it and, frankly, enjoying it very much. She was very gifted at making it into a kind of a game. You know, who can clean the most floor? Who can get the most done? Who can pick the most? Even now, when our grandchildren come up and dig potatoes, she calls it treasure hunting, which is fine with me. The kids are all out there digging potatoes, and then they call it treasure hunting. And then when it comes time to pick rocks out of the garden, I tell them I'll give them a penny or a nickel a rock. Penny didn't have much motivation. You know, inflation, even kids want more money today. So it's just made it fun, and it's sure a lot better than having to discipline or yell or whatever. Of course, yelling is not discipline. Yelling is what parents do when they don't know how to discipline. So this is one of the truths of life. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 6. These words which I command you today shall be in your heart. So first, the words of God have to be in us. It has to be in the parents. You can't just read it to them. The words of God must be in your heart. It says here, you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand. In other words, they'll be bound in your mind that you will teach your children God's way every single day, every aspect of the day. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and your gates, and show it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, and houses which you didn't dig. It was simply mentioned here down in verse, well, let's drop down here for the sake of time. Verse 17, you shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, his testimonies and his statutes which he has commanded you. And you shall do all that is right and good in the sight of the Lord your God. So we have this commandment from God. And then in verse 20, when your son asks of you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of these testimonies, the statutes, the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded you? Now, some children are more question-oriented than others. And my daughter Holly's oldest little granddaughter, and I've got to tell personal stories that I know. All of you have equally good or probably better stories about children. I know that Eloise has lots. But I don't know yours. I just know the ones that we have. So forgive me for getting a little too self-oriented here in the anecdotes. But we do have children who are very question-oriented. And my oldest granddaughter, for my daughter Holly, from the time she was little, she wanted to know how, why. Why is that? How? And just, when I build a fire in the house, how do you build a fire, Grandpa? And she's the same way today. She's constantly just a series of questions. And then we have other grandchildren that are not that way. But the children will ask, what is the meaning of God's law, the statutes, and the testimonies? Then you shall say, verse 21, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt. The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. So the answer is to tell them about your history. Tell them about your family history. Tell them about your church history, how God called you. Children need to have a basis of life. They need to know who they are and where they came from. As I mentioned, there were quite a large number of the Novak family at the feast over in Crete. In fact, Mr. Fish had all of them stand up with their kids. I think it was 53 total, and that was a wonderful thing. Everybody gave them a hand, and it was just a real touching moment during the feast. But it's important for our children to have some background and to know who they are and where they came from, both spiritually and physically speaking. Now, my family was a little better than that than my wife's. You know, my mother was a red-haired Italian, and the Italians are extremely family-oriented. If you've been to Italy, the cemeteries are beautifully taken care of. They have actually engraved very nice color portraits of the person on each one of the headstones. I don't know what it costs, but they're very, very nicely done. My mom had to go to all the family graves in the area, probably twice or three times, about every 3 or 4 months, make sure they were nice, put flowers out. And it was very important to her that we would take a trip up to Cayuga, Indiana, outside of Lebanon, Indiana, where there was a little white church. In that churchyard, there was a cemetery. And my mom could name all the relatives and the ancestors back to 1828, because some of them came out right after the Revolutionary War with George Rogers Clark and settled along the Wabash River. And so it was very important to my mom that we knew all of our ancestors' names going back to the ones that died in the early 1800s. And we also had our little families of, in fact, I met my aunt, my cousin in Italy over in a graveyard in Italy. And my dad wasn't quite as much, although the family stayed together. And I have my favorite picture of my father is that he's about 10 years old, standing in a little field of grass, wearing his single-sided overalls. And that's all he had, because they were so poor, they couldn't afford shoes, socks, or underwear. So he just showed me the picture. I've still got a copy of it. And he says, we were so poor that, you know, his dad had died when my father was a year and a half old. Grandma had taken in laundry to try to pay for the 8 or 9 children she was trying to raise. And it was a very, very time of just great poverty back in the Depression era that people today have no comprehension of it, just simply don't. But my father always wanted us to know where we came from and to appreciate the blessings we have. So don't take it for granted. It could all be taken away someday. He also wanted us to know about, you know, the things he did in the Air Force and that kind of thing. So it's nice to have stories of your parents. My wife loves to go up to see the grandkids and tell them farm stories. And some farm stories are really enjoyable. Then she starts telling farm stories on me, and I'm not sure I like it quite as much. But the grandkids think it's great to have a family history. A few years ago, when my wife, her mother's maiden name was Nanny, N-A-N-N-E-Y. It was a Welsh name. I never heard of anybody with that name. But after her mother was killed when she was 9, plus her grandmother, and the family kind of became separated. She hadn't met most of them, or hadn't met them for many, many years when we got married. But a number of years ago, she decided to kind of connect with that side of the family and get a little more background. And we did get a book that was written by Ira Dodge, who was her great-grandfather, wasn't it? Great-grandfather. And Ira Dodge was a famous bear hunter in Wyoming, and he took clients bear hunting like Teddy Roosevelt. So, you know, my mom, she says that my son is a hunter because of me. I think the DNA is on her side of the family just as much. So we have the story of Ira Dodge. It's in a book written up in the history of Wyoming, and that's her great-grandfather. But then she began to do a little more research from some of the aunts who are still alive, and they said there's a castle in Wales called the Nanny Castle, and that belongs to us. So I thought, well, this is pretty cool. So she went over a few years ago with Bridget, and they went up into Wales, and they found the Nanny Castle, spelled, the Gaelic spelling is N-A-N-N-E-U. There's books written about it, about the Nanny family, when they were at one point, you know, landed in fairly well-to-do part of the gentry. But it began to, I think, help her connect with her mother's family and back a number of generations and get a sense of who she is and where she came from. The same, I think, is true with us spiritually. We need to have a sense of who we are and where we came from. That's why God wrote Hebrews 11, all those great cloud of witnesses of people who have been called by God before us. And it's always been a disappointment to me that God did not call anybody else in my family, that I had to pretty much leave and just leave on my own. And it's been wonderful to have the church family ever since. But the challenge, of course, is that you know, we have to don't have anybody else in the family that I can share spiritual experiences with. But I certainly look forward to doing that someday when they're resurrected. So the number one requirement for child rearing is love and affection. We must love our children. We must make sure we don't cross any lines that would communicate to them that we don't. We don't want to be pestering them or constantly nagging them. As I said before, yelling at them. You know, what happens when people yell at each other? What's the result of that? Anyone know when there's really strong words? Well, there are barriers that build up. And a husband called me a couple years ago and said he and his wife had a little issue, and she left. And I said, well, did you yell at her? He said, well, yeah, but she yelled at me first. Well, that's okay. That doesn't justify it. I said, well, when a husband yells at his wife, normally it's about 24 days before that barrier begins to disappear. And sure enough, she moved back in 24 days later. But the thing of it is, if we yell at our children, we are creating barriers, and they will shut us out, and they will not want to hear us. They will not want to listen to us about God's truth or God's way of life. I've known a few families many, many years ago, not so much in recent times, where the father was overbearing about trying to teach his children, and instead of teaching them through inductive methods, trying to help the child realize and come to that conclusion themselves, that yes, we should follow God, we shouldn't steal, we shouldn't say bad things about others, we shouldn't do all these things that people do today. Just trying to pound it into their heads or threaten them or something just drives wedges between parents and children. And then later the children will seek their friends, they will seek others than their parents when it comes to later part of their life and asking advice, or at least wise, trying to share their lives. So the godly parent is loving, patient, kind, and affectionate towards his children, because 1 Corinthians 13 verses 4 and 5 tells us that love is patient and kind and is always able to be entreated. The second thing we must do is set the right example. You know, we know that children look at us and they learn how to behave. I guess this was first impressed on me when my son Ryan was born. He was still crawling around in diapers, And I was down in our basement of this little old house we had bought for very, very little in Pasco, and we were trying to remodel the basement into a reasonable place to use for an office or a bedroom. And I was able to scrap some trim, some wood trim off of a job. So I brought it down to the basement. I had my little hammer, and I'm down there trying to hammer this wood trim into the floor and then up a few of the seams on the paneling. I look over, and there's my little son, and he's got a stick, and he's pounding on the wood too. I thought, well, this guy's only about 18 months old, and he's already watching Dad and trying to, you know, pound this stick in. I thought, well, okay, I better start behaving because he's going to start imitating everything I do. They learn by example. And the one thing that children are also very akin to is parental hypocrisy. If they see mom and dad having roast minister after church or disobeying God in some way when they have heard in church or they know they shouldn't be doing it, it goes a long way towards, let's just say, eroding the confidence the children have in their parents. This article says, nothing renders a parent's efforts in childbearing more ineffective than simple parental hypocrisy. Children cannot be expected to adopt standards to which their parents are unwilling to adhere. So if we teach our child something, we better live it. We cannot be hypocritical and do something different. We mentioned about teaching, of course, and the last thing I want to mention is the most difficult, and that's the fourth key of child-rearing, and that is discipline. Discipline, of course, has been completely lost in our time. The Bible truths that are so plain are ignored or ridiculed. But let's start with the importance of a schedule. If a child has a schedule, it helps them learn that the world is organized. The world functions according to when things should be done and how they should be done. And as you know, my father was a Air Force colonel, and so let's just say that structure and having a schedule were very, very important. So much so that they were written on the wall in the kitchen, that everything had to be done at a certain time in a certain way. And my mom wasn't quite that way, so it was a little point of contention between them. But even after my parents were divorced, we still had to get up at the right time, go to school at 7:15 every morning, and then when we got home, we had to do our homework. We had a couple hours set for homework, and then we had maybe one half hour of watching the Jackie Gleason show or something, if there was time, and then we were in bed at 8 o'clock. There was never a time we were allowed to stay up past our bedtime. Now, my grandma thought just because school was out in the summer, it shouldn't affect her life. So at 7:15 in the morning, she kicked my brother and I out to the backyard and locked the door. And just said, go play with your friends or whatever you're going to do. And at lunchtime, she would hand us a sandwich and a glass of water out the back door, but she wouldn't let us in the house. And so we had like 35 other friends on the street. And so instead of watching TVs or watching screens of some kind, we went out and played catch, played rundown, played croquet, played basketball, anything we could do to have fun and keep ourselves active. So the discipline begins with the schedule and having things done in the right amount of time. There is also, as you know, a very large number of verses about discipline. We all know that God himself, in chapter 12 of Hebrews, says that every child of God is disciplined by God. He does it for our own good, and it's one that we must make sure we are understanding when God disciplines us. But physical punishment should not be the main feature of a child-rearing program. No child should ever be beat or hurt to the point where they are bruised or any vital organs. They do have a sit-and-down part. But parents can be very creative about discipline. You know, the spanking isn't the first or should be the first reaction or the first tool. There should be a lot more tools in your toolbox. And my father, for all of his faults and being an Air Force colonel, didn't want to spank his kids. I mean, maybe he did. We were very, very small. My mother, who, being a red-haired Italian, liked to spank kids, so that was a different approach. But my father, he thought, you know, the kids are always asking for money, and they're going to be working for money for the rest of their life. So when I was, I think, five, on Monday morning, he would stack up a stack of dimes and nickels and say, this is your allowance for the week, $1. And you'll get that on Saturday morning, less all the times you misbehave and I take nickels and dimes away. So if we smarted off to mom, off went a dime. Or if we did something else we shouldn't have done, off went a nickel. And it wasn't very long before my brother and I were actually getting most of that dollar at the end of the week. And my dad used to laugh because my first time I got a dollar allowance, I went down to the fishing store and bought all the weights I could buy for a dollar, fishing weights. But anyway, there are other things you can do. There are reward systems. There are systems of taking things away. My little grandson, Josiah, as I mentioned, always likes to carry his plastic sword around. He had his plastic sword stuff. He had his plastic sword with him everywhere for a couple of years. So about a year and a half ago, he did something he shouldn't have done, and so my daughter was going to put him in time out. But it was something with the sword. So she just takes the sword and puts it on top of the refrigerator, and she says, "Your sword is in time out." And he just lost it. "Oh, no, Mom, don't do that to my sword." I cried. He promised and promised to be good. On it goes. So putting the sword in time out was a very valuable tool. I'm not sure how many of you have a sword you can put in time out. But the point is, try to have other tools in your toolbox. Spanking, yelling shouldn't even be in your toolbox, but spanking and other things are to be a last resort. But most parents see the whole problem of discipline, their child rearing, as either being too strict or too lenient. But the honest answer is, you have to explain to your children why they are being disciplined. They have to understand. If you ever raised or trained a dog, training a dog can be a lot of fun. It can be very frustrating. But I've raised and trained about 4 bird dogs, not quite to the show dog trial, but frankly, very good. And I even had Stella out one time with a police dog. I met a policeman at the Target parking lot. And I said, "Look, he mentioned the dog and he had his dog." I said, "Well, let me show you what Stella can do." And so we both went around the parking lot with our dogs giving orders, stop, stay, come, you know, whistle, whatever. And he said, "Well, if she wasn't a hunting dog, I'd ask you to join the police force." But at any rate, a dog can be taught just to do it, because the dog doesn't reason and think. You don't have to explain to your dog why I want you to sit. You don't have to explain to your dog why I want you to fetch. You don't have to explain to your dog why he should be quiet. You just tell him to do it, and you teach him, and he learns the commands and the whistles, whatever it is, and that's it. A child, you need to explain why. At a certain age, I'd say beginning about age 18 months, maybe age 2, the child needs to understand why he shouldn't be stealing something that belongs to somebody else, or why he shouldn't be disrespectful to his parents. So explain to them, and then explain them what happens and why God wants them to obey and do what is right. This article says, "Parents shall always seek to explain their punishment to the child who is receiving it. He must be made to realize why he is being punished. He should understand the justice of that punishment. And parental justice should always fit the crime." So you don't over-punish, and you don't also just, you know, let things go to the place where it develops bad habits in the children. And one last point on punishment. Make sure you have all the facts. Make sure that if your child is doing something, or you think it's committed some sort of a, you know, punishable event, don't just quickly judge and go and do something, because there may be another side to the story. And we were first in Alaska. My son, what was Ryan? He was supposed to have been about 8, maybe been 9. But I came home in our first little rental house there, came home out in the garage, opened the garage door, and there was my tackle box open with this fishing gear. There were all sorts of plugs and fishing gear all rusted and just laying all over the place. And I thought, my son has been in my fishing gear and he's taken it out and left it out while it's wet. And now I've got all these plugs and all stuff that's all rusted and I can't even use them. So, of course, stupid me, I yell at him, "Brian, get in here!" Until he comes in to the garage. And I start yelling at him, "Who do you think you are getting in my tackle box? I didn't give you permission to do that." And just, you know how stupid dads can be sometimes? So just on, railing on him. I said, "You're going to have to replace those." And so he says, but, Dad, and his tears are coming down his eyes. And I said, What do you mean, but, Ryan? He said, "Dad," he said, "that wasn't your fishing gear." He said, "When the river was low, me and my friend went out to find fishing gear that was hooked on the rocks and collect it for you, and I thought you'd be happy to see it. It was a present for you." And I just wanted to go stand in the toilet and pull the plug. I mean, you know, you when you hurt your kids because you jump the gun or you assume something that isn't true, you can cause some real damage. Now, my son obviously forgave me, and we've been good fishermen, good buddies ever since. But just be careful that you don't discipline your child in anger or in a reaction. Make sure you have all the, and wait till you calm down. If you're upset, why don't you take 5 breaths first and calm down before you do something. Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 6, I'll just read this to you. You are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the people on the earth. And that is such a wonderful truth, such a wonderful blessing that God has given to us. The last thing I want to read is a letter, and this will be the, I've got a little bit of time. This is a letter by Richard D. Armstrong. Now, most of us don't remember him. He was Herbert Armstrong's oldest son. He was ordained to the ministry, went to Ambassador College, was, by all intents and purposes, had the gift of healing. I've talked to many people who said he, when he prayed for people who had terrible issues, they were always healed. But he was killed in a terrible car accident in 1963. But before he died, this is apparently the last letter he wrote. I understand this to be from what was written in the on the library. But he mentions here, to the brethren of the church in Fresno, from your pastor, Richard D. Armstrong. Last Sabbath, it was very nice to have Mr. Herbert Armstrong speak to us at the Ambassador Corral, a pleasure which we don't have often. And he mentions here a lot of nice things, but then he mentions that there was some damage to the building that they lived in, or that they rented. The church hall they rented had some damage to the plumbing, whatever it might be. So he says, these things must be dealt with, so we will lose our hall if they don't. We do not have these problems. They must be solved. They must be solved by the scriptures and in God's way. Many of you have felt that perhaps it would be better to leave your children at home, but the Bible commands you to bring them into the services, and it commands them to be quiet. So for a number of months, I've been concerned that we've had too many people out in the foyers during church. We should be in this room. It's a blessing to have a big, big building like this, isn't it? But sometimes it's too big, and sometimes we can just sort of get lost and not find people. Several times I've gone home Monday morning, I'll call somebody up and say, I didn't see you at church. How you doing? I was at church. Oh, really? I didn't see you. Well, I was there. You know, this place is just big and people can walk around. But we should be together in one room, and children should be taught to sit and be quiet and to listen. They can begin to take notes as soon as they can begin to write. He mentions here that the children are also to keep the Sabbath. God says in Leviticus 23, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord. For in it you shall not do any work, nor your son nor your daughter. So the Sabbath is also created by God for our children. And in the very end of the church, of this article, he says, in two hours a week is not too long for your children to sit still and listen to the services and stay after and visit with people. I'm kind of summarizing that part of it. But your children must be in church because God considers them as holy. And I think that's a very important principle. So he ends up with the article mentioning here, you have to shape and mold and develop the character of your children so they will learn to love God and hate evil. Turn to Leviticus 19:32. God says, you shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. So Mr. Armstrong at this point connected the idea of keeping the Sabbath and reverencing the sanctuary or the place in which we meet. He says, regarding them, he mentions here not to deal in idolatry in any way. And then he says, verse 19, verse 32, teach your children to rise up before the hoary head and honor the face of the old man and to fear your God. I am the Lord. And so this article, Mr. Armstrong, by the way, the introduction here by Herbert Armstrong says, I want this letter read in every church in worldwide at that point. So it's such a wonderful thing to be able to have children, to be able to bless them, and to be able to know that we are headed towards, hopefully, a time when the world will have nothing but wonderful things for children, wonderful experiences for them and for parents. Let's go back to Malachi chapter. Let's go back to Malachi chapter 2. We read that earlier, but I want to get the entire context. We read verse 15. But let's begin in Malachi chapter 5 and verse 10. This is a six-verse description of why God made marriage and why he hates divorce. But he made marriage to develop righteous children and righteous families. That's God's building block, not only for the earth, but I think also for his church, as we're finding out in the days in which we live. He says in verse 10 of Malachi chapter 2, have we not all one Father? Have we not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously with one another? By profaning the covenant of our fathers. Judah has dealt treacherously with one another, And I mean, Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. Now, what is the abomination that he's talking about being committed in Israel and in Jerusalem? For Judah has profaned the Lord's holy institution, which he loves. So what is the holy institution that God loves? Well, it's marriage. It's the family. He has married the daughter of a foreign god. So in other words, they have married someone that would not worship God with them, the daughter of a foreign god. He says, may the Lord cut off from the tents of Jacob the man who has done this thing, being awake and aware. For you bring an offering, yet you do this thing, but bring an offering to the Lord of hosts. And this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears. What does it mean to cover the altar of the Lord with tears? He goes on to say, that's a wife who has been abandoned by her husband, left all alone. And sadly, in my ministry, I've had a few phone calls from wives who discovered their husband had committed adultery, or there was some other issue that was going to destroy their marriage. And the pain and the sobbing and the crying on the other end of the phone is something I can't tolerate. It's just too much sometimes. What do you say? Oh, it'll be all right? No, it won't be all right. You're supposed to mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with those who rejoice. But how do you mourn with someone who is going through something like that? That's how the altar of God is deframed. Here it mentions how it's covered with tears, with weeping and crying. Does he not regard the offering any more, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands? Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth. This is a picture of an abandoned wife of their youth, or one who has been betrayed, covering the altar of God with her tears. That should never happen in the church of God. God never intended it to happen among the human family, but it happens way too often. It says, for she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Did he not make them one? He made one wife for Adam. He made them one, the unit, husband and wife, having a remnant of the Spirit, being a reflection of the Spirit of God. And why one? Why did God create Adam and Eve? Why one family? Because he seeks godly offspring. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none of you deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. So it's a wonderful institution that God made. Husband and wife made them one, reflective of God's Spirit, which Paul talks about in Ephesians 5, about how the church is teaching all about adultery and about the Spirit of God, or the way husbands and wives should treat each other. And then he says, well, I'm really talking about Christ and the church. And this chapter in Malachi is reflective of the same thing. So what a great blessing it is to know that. What a great blessing it is to look towards having a happy marriage, or being in one, a marriage where you can worship God together, where you can be partakers of the grace of life, and then, of course, enjoy the wonderful blessing of having children and learning to teach them, learning to be with them, do things with them, to love them, and then, of course, then eventually having grandchildren and be as the Proverbs say, you know, the happiness is having your grandchildren upon your knee, and it certainly is a wonderful blessing. So just thought I would give a child-rearing sermon and kind of review some of those basic principles, but I hope that our children continue to be blessed with wonderful parents and wonderful families.